let's let the tape roll. These mysterious people back here turning everything on. The title of the Johannine biblical presentation today, according to my notes, is Signs of Life. And let me review both for you and for me. It's where I plan to be each day in this series of five. Yesterday we looked at John 5, 19 to 29 under the title Life Here and Now. And you will recall that our operational definition of life for the week is, this is one dimension of it, life always involves struggle. So we spent some time yesterday looking at Raymond Brown's analysis, after 25 years of study of John's Gospel, of the community of the beloved disciple. And those of you who weren't here yesterday will notice the many-dimensional symbol of the two eagles either locked in combat, which was Brown's intention, or locked in mating and unity, which came out of the reality of life. And one of the points I'm going to make today is that the Gospel of John invites us to see through signs into reality. And that's a working definition that will probably come up several times during this hour. A true sign in the Johannine sense is a window onto reality. We'll come back to that. Anyway, that was the topic yesterday, life here and now. The topic today is signs of life, and we're going to look at the beginning and at the end of the hour at the text in John 2, 1 to 11, which the author says, about what the author says, this was the first of the signs. Then tomorrow, the topic is the shepherd gives life, John 10, and if things work according to my notes and my plans, will come in at the end, just about 1 minute before coffee in the pool hall, asking ourselves what life means when the good shepherd is the giver of life. Then the fourth presentation, which I think comes Friday, is Life for the World, a re-examination of John 3:16 in context. We'll be looking at John 3:14 to 21, and around the concept of the world in John's Gospel, we will see again struggle. Because the notion of the world in Greek, cosmos, is both the object of God's love in Christ and the enemy. We'll go into some of the stuff you folks are talking about in great complexity, but it is the world is the enemy in John, but the world is also the object of God's love. Then the last presentation this week, Friends for Life, talking that, I call these titles cute titles, but that's probably not really fair, because it is in the Johannine idiom and in the Johannine wavelength to try to use language in such a way that has multi-dimensional meanings. That's why I repeat today, for those who weren't here yesterday, the warning I was given when I was working for LWF years and years ago by a young man who has since become a patriarch of one of the Syrian Orthodox churches, when he told me, Peter, you folks in the West cannot understand John. I can look at you because you weren't here yesterday, so I can tell the story to you. And you can't understand John because you people with your Western mind think truth is what you have left when you've gotten rid of all the stuff that's nearly true or problematic on both sides, and you've got a little bit in the middle that you can put into propositional truth, and the Western mind thinks it's got truth. He said, we in the East know that truth is like a snowball coming down the hill. It starts small, and then it grows and grows and grows and gathers meaning into it. And so what we're doing now is in this study of John, and what John does in, or the school of John, or the community of the Beloved Disciple did in writing the gospel, was intentionally let truth snowball. And that's going to be also true of the topic today, signs of life. Now let's start by getting the text in front of us.
Sir?
Yes?
What do you mean by Johannine?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for the question. That's the whole body of literature that is sort of related to John's gospel. So John's gospel, the fourth gospel, is part of the Johannine literature. Then the first called in our scripture, the first, second, and third letters of John, they go together to form within our scripture the Johannine literature, and very often the book of Revelation is added there too. It's kind of a section that we would call generally the Johannine material in the New Testament, like you have the Pauline material, then you have Luke and Acts that you call the Lucan material. So you've got chunks of material, and the way, you weren't here yesterday then.
Yes, I was.
Oh, you were. Well, then it was the same sort of, that's this whole capitalized adjective to describe that whole bunch of material, Johannine material. And the same sort of theories that Brown puts together on the development of the Johannine community, other people will talk about in connection with this great body of interesting literature, Luke and Acts, the Lucan community. Okay, any other questions? Because I think that's always helpful if we get questions. Now, my plan is to read this text, the first of the signs, through once, then try to indicate by illustrations in the gospel and even outside of the gospel what is really involved with the word sign, semeion in Greek, and then come back to the text and then at the end pay up on a sentence which is very important to me, and we'll do this one twice. The Gospel of John and its whole idiom invites us, or calls the readers of the gospel, the first readers and us, to see life, and there's that word again, that multidimensional, see life through these signs. Remember, they're windows on reality. And then the implication is that we are also called to discern signs all over our life. How many went to Vespers last night? Well, you notice what Anita did with chapter 9, the whole text of the man born blind. We'll come back to that later. She re-minted it into another idiom and used it to explain how a gay person in facing his or her reality has his or her eyes opened. Now whether you agree with that or not is a way of interpreting that text. The point I'm making is that the mood, the mode, the idiom of John's gospel invites that kind of reinterpretation. So I'll repeat my sentence. The gospel calls us and the first readers to see life, reality, through these signs, and also, I think, invites us to discern signs all over the life that we live. Now that's the more problematic, and I hope we have time for discussing it. Now let's read, as we did yesterday, the text. And I put up on the, what are these? These aren't blackboards. What are these?
Whiteboards,
whatever. Several words to look for as we read through this text. O woman, my hour, feast, signs, glory. I've been teaching John as a non-Johannine expert now for over 10 years, maybe. And each time I go through it with the students, I'm more amazed at the intentional artistry, if that's not too weak a word, sort of the mystic depths, you can even say, of almost every text there. Almost the whole gospel is hinted at in this text. Almost the whole gospel. And motifs, sort of like musical da-da-da-da, are set in motion with each of these words that will have its own great expression later. Da-da-da-da, something like that in that whole chapter. And then will be echoed again. That's the kind of material John's gospel is. In that sense, it's very much different from the synoptics, that is Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which bodies of literature or traditions talk about the same phenomenon of Jesus and use much of the same material. But John looks beyond, behind, and into the depth of meaning. Remember I said yesterday, John is the only gospel that as part of the story, includes the reflection of the disciples. Remember, many texts, if you're familiar with that, it'll say, and the disciples remembered what he said, and finally, they understood. And only John's gospel has these, we're not going to touch with them on them these 2 weeks because we don't have time for it, but only John's gospel has the notion of the paraclete or the comforter or the spirit that will lead into all the truth. So part of the struggle in the process of the writing of John's gospel is to look at these traditions that probably came to the writer or writers' traditions about Jesus in oral form and to look at them, meditate on them, read them probably out in communities like this, and then finally see the depth of meaning in these texts, which were also in their own way signed. So now let's start reading, and we're going to come back to these words. I'll touch on them a little bit in my creative interruption fashion as we read, and then we'll come back to them after we've gone over what John means by signs. Will somebody start? Read? Each read a sentence.
On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there.
Now, let me just get you thinking a little bit about this. There is no virgin birth in John. And when we get into the next sentence or so, we'll find Jesus talking to his mama in a way that the scholars tell us no Jewish boy should talk to his mama. No Jewish boy should talk to his mama. And so you can just ask the question. It's kind of, again, a cute question, but it has all kinds of interesting theological implications. They answer both for then and now. Would you talk to a woman like that if you knew she was the Queen of Heaven or was going to become the Queen of Heaven? In the second week, I'm going to spend 5 hours on women in John's Gospel, and Mary is one of them. And this is the first time, she appears in this Gospel. In Mark, there is no virgin birth account, but in Matthew and Luke, in those communities, it was important. They have different access to ground in each of those communities. It was important to get Mary in there and defined very early. This is Mary's first appearance on the Johannine stage. Okay, where were we? I was interrupting. All I know is, okay, take a run at it, okay?
You want me to read?
Start all over again, because I'm confusing everybody.
On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the wedding.
She got the first invitation, apparently. He was also invited. Okay, go ahead.
When the wine ran short, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, how does your concern affect me? My hour has not yet come."
My what?
My hour.
Does anybody want to know what his hour is going to be? I think John intended his readers to say, "Aha, what is that? My hour." The Greek is he hora. Just throw that in for edification. Okay, go ahead.
His mother said to the servers, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish ceremonial washings, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus told them, "Fill the jars with water."
So why did they have to be, jars for purification? Now, they probably were. I wasn't there. But the writer of this gospel is setting in motion another motif. And this one, Raymond Brown picks up in his 2-volume commentary. It goes from feast to feast to feast to feast. And finally, Jesus dies in connection with the Passover. And so one of the motifs that moves through John's Gospel is that Jesus and his movement replaces one after another the most meaningful feasts of the Jewish religion. No wonder there was conflict. Okay, and what I'm saying now is that just in this preliminary look at this text, almost everything that gets touched on in the Gospel is implicit or sounded here. Okay, let's get somebody else over here to read so that it comes in the other ear. Start with 7.
Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the steward of the feast." So they took it. When the steward of the feast tasted the water now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and when men have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now."
Now, wait, let me just interrupt again. What does wine mean? What does wine mean? There's all these levels, again, being touched on. Is it the wine of communion? I don't think so. Raymond Brown thinks so. But maybe the writer of the gospel is wanting to suggest things. Go ahead.
This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
Okay, signs and glory. We'll come back to those words as we go, after we've gone through this introduction to what signs mean in John's Gospel. Many scholars refer to the first section of John from the end of the prologue, which is John 1 to 18 or so, up until the end of chapter 12. And we're going to spend some time in the transition texts at the end of chapter 12. They refer to this chunk of John's Gospel as the Book of Signs. Now, strictly speaking, there are only two texts which are called signs. This is called the first of the signs, and then the next one is, I think it's 4, is it 18? Let's look at that. 4:18. I had written it down wrong for the first hour. No, it's 54. 4:54, is that right? Yes, that's it. 4:54. I had written it down 2:54 in my notes. The other sign is the healing of the official's son. Now, those are the only two places where a specific miracle is called a sign. However, I want us to jump to the end of the gospel to justify what we're going to do with the notion of signs. In a sense, at the end of the gospel, 20, 30, and 31, you can say, and you see, 21 is kind of an epilogue, and you could argue, as some scholars do, that the gospel itself ends with 20, 30, and you can, after we read it, you'll see that it gives us leave to look at the whole of the gospel as a collection of signs. Now, we haven't yet defined what that means in terms of the text. I've given you the definition. It's a window onto reality. But let's just read 30 and 31, somebody, please.
Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples.
And remember, this comes at the very end of the gospel, so the whole thing is a collection of signs, okay?
Which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name.
Okay, that's an echo of what we did yesterday, 5:24. The one who believes has already passed from death into life, does not come into the judgment, but already lives. Now, that's the framework for what I want to go through now, and I want just to sort of survey what's going on in the first 12 chapters. You have this sign in chapter 2, then you have the cleansing of the temple. Isn't that in chapter 2? Just check. It's there. It's not called a sign, but it is one of the signs. Now, what kind of a sign? And it's an event, but an event that has deep, deep meaning. What kind of a sign would the cleansing of the temple be? The same kind of a sign that you have in the changing of the water into wine. The water for Jewish purification becomes, under the miracle, something new, something brand new. But it's a sign, not in the first instance, a miracle. And that's the point I want to make right here at the beginning. Look at 4:48, and let's read that. And this is only illustrative of a number of passages in John's Gospel where Jesus sort of scolds people for believing because of miracle. For believing because of miracle. Let's just read that.
Jesus said to him, "Will none of you ever believe without seeing signs and portents?" The officer pleaded with him, "Sir, come down before my boy dies."
Okay, the thing is, you mean you Jesus is sort of scolding him, saying, are you going to believe just because you see miracles? Just because you see miracles? Now, if you read John very carefully, in comparison particularly with Mark, you'll discover that half of Mark, scholars have even counted verses and words and incidents, half of Mark is devoted to the miracle power of Jesus, where Jesus goes in and zaps Satan. Zaps Satan. And drives out demons. There's no demon driving out in John. And there are many fewer, more selected miracles in John. And John wants to call it not miracle, but sign. Because it's the use of power in John's telling of Jesus' story is not to knock you over and say, you better believe or you're going to get it. It's to say this power will open up the window of reality so you can see what life is really all about. So some of the most clearly symbolic signs are Jesus opens the eyes of the man born blind and then says, I am what? The light of the world. And the text that Anita read last night and paraphrased, we should have read the whole chapter because that's really rich. She jumped into the end of it, where the chapter says to the Pharisees, you say you see, but now that the light has come, you don't really see. You've been made blind, and other people are seeing. So it's this, the sign, is, you know, the sign, once you open this window on reality, and I've got to shift images now, it opens up to larger and larger vistas of reality, like you throw a dye into the water and then the circle of the color increases and increases and increases. And that is what a sign is all about. You don't just believe because the miracle zaps you. You believe because what the Matthew, Mark, and Luke call a miracle, and what John calls a sign, the sign opens up so you can see what really is, and in seeing real reality, you live. Another sign, quite obvious, in chapter 6, one of the toughest chapters of John's Gospel. Jesus has fed the multitude, and that's the miracle stuff of it. But the important thing is that he says, I am the bread of life. I am the bread of life. And then you pick up the image of the manna and all that, and you have a sign. He is the one. And eating his flesh and drinking his blood, which Luther says has nothing to do with the Eucharist, but has everything to do with belief, with faith, that is the true life. And so the signs go on and on. And my point is that all of them move toward the one great sign, and that's where we're coming back to signs and glory and my hour. An image that is very important in John and not found in the synoptic tradition, the image of the Son of Man being lifted up. Let's look at 3:14. Let's look at 3:14. How are we doing for time? Well, I guess we're okay. We got half an hour. Somebody read 3:14. Now, 3:14 does not appear in Matthew, Mark, or Luke. This is John's, or the Johannine community's, way of pulling the whole thing together. Read it, please.
And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him may have eternal life.
Do you remember that text from Numbers 21:9? If you look carefully at the Gospel of John, it reflects the Exodus in many, many subtle ways. What happened? I can still remember. My grandmother Larson taught the kindergarten class in our old country, serpent up, and folks would turn and look at it, and the snakes would start falling off and stuff. I remember that was a 3-4-year-old. I mean, I'll die with that image in my memory. It's so powerful. But it's a strange one. And John uses that almost literally, sign. For as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man, and that's the self-designation of Jesus in the synoptic Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or oral tradition. So John is using the materials of his tradition. So must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him may have eternal life. An echo of what we did yesterday, John 5:24. Anyone who believes has already moved from death to life, whatever that means. Now, I want to transition into the idea of the hour, my hour, by having us read John 12:27-43. That's almost the last text in what the scholars call the Book of Signs. Before we get to 13-17, which is the upper room, beginning with the sign of Jesus washing the disciples' feet. You know, there's no institution of the Lord's Supper in John, but there is the foot washing. In the place where the oral tradition or the synoptic tradition had the Lord's Supper. And then at the end of that interesting section, 13-17, you have the high priestly prayer, the one that was mentioned also in the service last night. Other sheep I have who are not of this fold, and they must be brought in also. Very interesting. What we want to do now is look at this transition text at the end of the Book of Signs, John 12:27-43, and look at it in terms of the notion of Jesus as the sign of God, Jesus the Son of Man who is lifted up. And then we ask the question about the hour and about glory. Will somebody begin, please?
Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour.
May I interrupt? Some scholars call this the Johannine Gethsemane, because there's no Gethsemane text in John. So this is the way the Johannine community or the John authors deals with this notion, this very powerful notion, this powerful text in the synoptic tradition, which does not appear in John. Okay, go ahead.
No, for this purpose I have come to this hour.
This hour started way out when Jesus said to his mother, "Woman, my hour has not yet come." Now, the hour, Heora, has come. It will be the hour of glory. And what is very difficult for many people then and for many people now to think about is the hour of glory is the moment of self-sacrifice. That is the glory. That is more the glory in John's gospel than the resurrection. So glory gets reinterpreted. Glory is itself, in a sense, a sign, a window onto reality. The reality of glory is not the crown, but the cross. Now that's getting ahead of the story a little bit. Keep reading.
"Father, glorify thy name." Then a voice came from heaven, "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." The crowd standing by heard it and saw it and said that it had thundered. And others said, "An angel has spoken to him." Jesus answered, "This voice has come for your sake, not for mine. Now is the judgment of this world."
Okay, great. The sign that will be put up, Son of Man, like the serpent in the wilderness, it's a sign of what? The signs of life are both signs of judgment, like the cleansing of the temple, and of grace. And the cross, in John's theology, is both judgment and grace. See, it's not either this or that, as truth rolls down the hillside like the snowball. It's both. And you are invited to figure it out. Okay, keep going.
"Now shall the ruler of this world be cast out, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself."
And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. Very, very interesting. Jesus is claiming for himself that as the sign of God lifted up from the earth on the cross, he will draw all people to himself. Okay, let's go. Keep going. Don't go ahead. I'm not interrupting this time.
"He said this to show by what death he was to die. The crowd answered him, 'We have heard from the law that the Christ remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is this Son of Man?'"
That's a very opaque and difficult sentence. In the text warm-up for the staff, they asked me about that sentence, and I'm going to tell this crowd that if anybody wants to ask me about that sentence, see me afterward, because I don't know exactly how to answer their question. But go ahead. It can be answered, but it's a long answer, okay? Yeah, well, no, let's get somebody else, because I've interrupted you so much, you must be a nervous wreck. Anybody, let's get a man over here someplace. Cause we've had, well, anybody.
"Who is the Son of Man?" Jesus said to them, "The light is with you for a little longer."
Okay, let me interrupt, I'm so sorry. Son of Man is the self-designation of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John uses it also. But here you see John answering their question about the Son of Man with his imagery. "I am the light of the world." Now, pick it up.
"The light is with you for a little longer. Walk while you have the light, lest the darkness overtake you. He who walks in the darkness does not know where he goes. while you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light.
That we were supposed to be committing ourselves to inclusive language, so we probably should say that you may become children of light or sons and daughters of the light. We don't have to be legalistic about it, but it's all right to keep a little consciousness, raisedness alive. So if you edit as you go along, that's okay. Keep reading, please.
When Jesus had said this, he departed and hid himself from them. Though he had done so many signs before them, yet they did not believe in him.
Okay, let me interrupt there. Though he had done so many signs before them. That's another argument that I picked up from 20, 30, and 31, that the whole gospel is really a book of signs. And the crucifixion, the moment of glory, the moment, the hour, is the chief sign. But here it's brought to expression too. Now, what is a sign? I said a sign is a window on reality. A sign is also something that really happens. It's not an idea, it's an event. And a sign is, in a sense, also a parable. And it's very interesting that the text you will be reading now, the tough text from Isaiah about hardening of heart, is the text that is quoted in Mark, Matthew, and Luke, the synoptic tradition, when the disciples asked Jesus about why he teaches in parables. And he says, I teach in parables because some will be blinded and some will harden their hearts. It's a method of teaching, an invitation to live in a new reality. And if you don't get inside that new reality, you aren't going to see. You're going to be blind. So it's interesting that at this point, about the meaning of signs in John's Gospel, the same tough Isaiah text is quoted, that is quoted in the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, when they ask about parables. Okay, go ahead.
It was that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Lord, who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Therefore they could not believe. For Isaiah again said, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, lest they should see that with their eyes and perceive with their heart and turn for me to heal them.
That's tough. That's really tough. He has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, their heart, lest they should see with their eyes and perceive with their heart and turn for me to heal them. That's back to my motif about conflict, about struggle, and to the notion that when you believe, it's sort of an either, it's the great either or. That's in John's Gospel. Okay, bring us home on that text, please.
Isaiah said this because he saw his glory and spoke of him. Nevertheless, many, even of the authorities, believed in him. But for fear of the Pharisees, they did not confess it, lest they should be put out of the synagogue. For they loved the praise of people more than the praise of God.
How about that? The praise of people more than the praise of God. Now that's something, if we do our thing Thursday night on sources of anti-Semitism in John's Gospel, this is one of the very complex passages, because there are some of the Judeans or Jews that believe, but they're afraid of the Pharisees. Sometimes the title Jews refers just to the leaders of the Jews, sometimes also to the people. But we'd have to look at texts like that if we talk about the Johannine or New Testament roots of Christian anti-Semitism. But the point we're making with this complex text now is that this sets it up, that the readers, the original hearers of this will say, the hour is going to be celebrated when the Son of Man is lifted up. That will be the hour of glory, and that will be the supreme sign that will draw all people to him. I've taken this long trek through John to just try to make one very, I think, central and exciting point, that we are invited to see all of life through the supreme sign that is Jesus on the cross, and then through all the other signs that really are all the texts and dramas of John. Now let's just run back very quickly and read our text again, 2:1-11, and see if you don't hear it slightly differently this time when you know you're reading the first of the signs. And even this very superficial and swift survey of what the gospel means by sign, I think you will understand what I claimed earlier, that almost every big motif in John is enunciated or set into motion here. Let's get one person to read it. Would you like to do that? Anybody who's wearing orange, I'm sure, would want to read the whole text, okay? That's a liturgical color, isn't it? Okay, read it 2:1-11. Well, she could be a Bronco fan in Denver. Okay, let's go.
On the third day, there was a marriage at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the marriage with his disciples. When the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "O woman, what hath you to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now 6 stone jars were standing there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. And Jesus said to them, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the steward of the feast." So they took it. When the steward of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and when men have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
Did you hear all the stuff we had been talking about now sort of spelled out in the rest of the gospel, already hinted at here? The point I want to make after this second read through is to build up the definition of sign. A sign is always something that really happened, a real event, and this event you have to be able to discern the meaning of the sign. And this sign, the wedding at Galilee, is both in its eventness and the way it's told in John's Gospel, opens up all kinds of concentric circles of meaning, expanding circles of meaning, like the die thrown in the water and moving out. And that's one of the things I want to say. A sign, if we're going to talk about signs, must be something that really happened. Now, as we come in for a landing, I want to read my sentence again that I think is the implication of this whole topic, signs of life in the Johannine mood. In John's Gospel, we, the readers today, and the original readers were called, challenged to see all of life and meaning through signs, particularly the sign Jesus lifted up, like the serpent in the wilderness. But also that we are invited to discern signs in all of our life. Let me just illustrate what I mean. A sign has to be something that really happens. Now, how many were at the forum last night? Well, didn't you think Mark Johnson's image of our imaging our addiction to fossil fuel as somebody rolling his own cigarettes from Rembrandt's was an absolutely stunning and fun and chilling image? But it's not a sign. He was at the study this morning. I said, unless Mark knows people that really roll Rembrandts, or even take one little corner of a Rembrandt and roll it in a cigarette, it's not a sign. It's just a stunning image. But I want to run past you a couple of signs that I have seen recently in my life. Signs that also have these concentric circles of meaning and of implication, like the die thrown in the water. I come from Denver. Rocky Flats is a place where they have stored toxic waste for a long time, and there's been a tumult about it for a number of years. Now, the government and the agencies are beginning to admit that all kinds of people around Rocky Flats are being seriously damaged by the water. So our papers were filled with headlines of, and even pictures, as I recall, of the government bringing to these people, a selection of 35 families or something like that, daily bottled, distilled water.
Rocky Mountain Arsenal.
Is it Rocky Mountain or is it? Okay, whatever. It's there. I get it mixed up. My wife would have it clear. But anyway, the point is still, it's still a sign. Because when you start looking at the meaning, the water, just think of all the image in John's Gospel about the water of life, all that, many levels of meaning. The water cannot be consumed by humans. The government, the power, can't clean up the water. So they don't return people to living water, they have to bring it in glass bottles. There's all kinds of implications there. And a sign, now the sign by itself, standing by itself, a sign that you see in life has, for Christians, I think, relatively little meaning unless it is related to the sign, which we want to talk about tomorrow, Jesus' cross. Now, you put the two there, and you can spend weeks, more than our symposium or whatever it was last night, saying, what is our role? What comes out of, what action, what insight comes out of juxtaposing these two signs? But that's what you do in the Johannine idiom. I think most of us are afraid to see and read signs because the statisticians and the experts who run our country will say, you're just telling anecdotal truth. There are hundreds of places in the United States where there's good water and all that. Another sign. How many of you come from the Twin Cities area? Well, in the Twin Cities, one of the papers this summer, there was a brilliantly written feature article that I didn't bring along about the wife of one of our recent seminary graduates. I won't tell you his name, not that it's secret, but anyway, they have been married for about 3 years. They fell in love on internship and were married. And she has environmental illness. 3 years ago, she was, well, 4 years ago maybe, she was hiking in the mountains and picked up fleas. And they used a certain pesticide on her clothes in her apartment to get rid of the fleas. She was working in a bank and did not know at that time that the bank was spraying for varmints with the same pesticide. And suddenly she became ill. And she was got some treatment that was really very, very bad, and the same chemical apparently was used in some of the treatment. I don't understand the details of this. The upshot is that her immune system is just about destroyed. She has to live in a house. He's got a call in the Dakotas now, but the article was written in the Twin Cities, in a house that was specially built. Jim, to come to be with her, has to take two sets of showers and wear a particular kind of clothing. Just an immense tragedy. The title of the article is what made it a sign. The title was Canary in a Cage. Remember the old mining practice? If the poison gas was coming, the miners couldn't detect it, but the canary they carried in the cage, and I remember as a child seeing that picture, would wilt or die, and then they knew they had, was it 10 minutes to get out? And this very perceptive team of writers in the Minneapolis paper called her a canary in the cage, because we, and she spends her time, she can't get out. She can't even see sunlight anymore. But she writes under special conditions and telephones limited times during the day because the plastic gives off, in the telephone, gives off stuff that sets up all kinds of reactions to other people who have this immune disease. And they are the canaries of our society. The writer dared to see this as a sign. I hardly dare to see it. I don't want to believe that this is happening to us. And that there are some humans that are the victims trying to warn us. Now, I say the Gospel of John invites us to see and discern signs like this. And it is, I must say this theologically and also existentially, it is relatively meaningless unless we juxtapose that sign to the sign, the supreme sign, the light of the world. And there is no easy answer when you juxtapose these two signs. It calls for forum after forum after forum, for struggle after struggle after struggle in the Christian and in the national community, but it calls us back to life rather than death. I got one more sign. This is too bad because I just talk and you don't discuss. I got one more sign, and that's the sign of Bambi. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? The sign of Bambi? I again live in Colorado. And the Silverado scandal there, the savings and loan company that failed there, it will cost us $1 billion to rescue, had on its board Neil Bush. And if you've seen him on TV, he's a gentle, winsome guy who looks a little bit like Bambi. And they, the newspapers, not too gently in Denver, have called him Bambi. And he went on the offensive when he was accused, because he was on the board of the Silverado Savings Loan that authorized all these huge millions of dollars of lines of credit to friends of his. And one of the stories is that he invested $100 in something that gave him $100,000 line of credit. And he gets on the radio and says, "I'm totally innocent. That's the way things work." And I, you know, he was a guy with a learning disability, and his mother worked with him and brought him through, and there's kind of a winsome success story. But he says, "I am innocent." And I think he believes it. And if you dare to see it, this is another sign. I think it's a sign of the destructiveness, the inadvertent destructiveness in our system. This is terrible for me to end with this. And I say again, this sign has no meaning, and if it stands alone, but it must stand in juxtaposition, in dialogue, in struggle with our sign, which is that God's truth, God's glory, is revealed in the sign that's lifted up in the wilderness, in the sign of the Good Shepherd who gives life for the sheep. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. And I hope we can talk about some of these little bombshells that I've laid out. Anyway, signs of life was the topic, and I think we were somewhat true to the Johannine idiom.